our patients tell us that they see no better use of their precious kidney transplant than using it to help them achieve their very precious family.
I hope that we won't be in a position 10 years from now where we don't have an answer to the question of, do SGLT2 inhibitors decrease cardiovascular and renal adverse outcomes in the transplant population?
Over 60% of Americans actually endorse considering donating a kidney, but only about 6,000 living kidney donors actually occur each year.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks from Duke University. Today, we're discussing kidney transplantation and advances that we're seeing in the field. We're joined today by Dr. Sunita Singh from Toronto, and she'll discuss her article published in CJS entitled Efficacy, Mechanisms, and Safety of SGLT2 Inhibitors in Kidney Transplant Recipients, a Randomized Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Trial. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here and speak about this trial. As you mentioned, I'm a transplant nephrologist out of the University of Toronto. In particular, I do a lot of work looking at the mechanistic effects of novel glucose-lowering therapies, including SGLT2 inhibitors. And in particular, this trial is looking at the results of SGLT2 inhibitors on various mechanisms in transplant recipients. So lots of work going on in the lab pertaining to these agents and in particular in transplant recipients.
As a nephrologist and a flozinator, I'm very much a fan of SGLT2 inhibitors. And you know, I think as time has gone on, getting more and more comfortable prescribing these drugs to patients with kidney transplants. So when you see a study that says randomized controlled trial and transplant, I had to immediately open up and look at it. So tell us about the evolution of this study. How did you get it started, and what was the process for getting this moving forward?
One of the things that we were seeing is, as you know, there were a lot of large outcome trials looking at these agents, SGLT2 inhibitors, in terms of cardiorenal protection, but none of those trials included transplant patients. What we also know is that transplant patients have a huge burden of cardiovascular disease and chronic kidney disease, and there's definitely a gap, a critical need, and a gap for therapies to protect cardiovascular and kidney systems in transplant recipients. And so when we saw that, we said, well, these trials are great. These agents seem great. But of course, we don't know how these agents work in this population of transplanted patients. And this is a population that has a huge need for cardiorenal protective strategies. The reason that we wanted to do this trial is to answer that question in this unique population that has a lot of kind of differences: immunosuppressed, denervated kidney, potential for drug-drug interactions. Can we get to the answer of, are these drugs going to be helpful and safe in this group of patients? And so that's what really triggered us to put together this trial. Of course, we all know that large outcome trials are what we want, but we also understood that that is challenging to do, especially in transplant recipients. And so that was the beginning of this mechanistic trial to try to understand, can we elucidate those mechanisms in this population?
I see the number of patients isn't absolutely mind-blowing, just 52, but utilizing them and getting all the data and information, I think you guys did a wonderful job. One thing I wanted to point out, right now we're sitting in, hard to believe, at 2026, and it takes a lot of time and effort to do a study like this. Can you tell us, when did this start and what was known about SGLT2 inhibitors and kidney transplantation then as opposed to now?
Yes, it was a very different time then. There was very little data in terms of dedicated renal trials. There was, of course, cardiovascular trials, and we could see the secondary outcomes of those cardiovascular trials in terms of renal protection, but there were very few dedicated renal trials that were published. In fact, DAPA-CKD was published while we were in the middle of this INFINITY study. And so we actually didn't know that much then from dedicated renal trials, but we certainly had the cardiovascular outcome trials for SGLT2 inhibitors then. We also kind of started planning the study a long time ago, I think writing up the grant and getting funding in 2017, 2018. And then of course, when we were ready to go, the pandemic hit. And so it was a very challenging time to try to recruit patients for a transplant trial that required them to come to the hospital, to the physiology lab to conduct several physiological assessments when people were being told to stay home, particularly the most vulnerable, including immunosuppressed populations. So it was a very big challenge for us. It actually took us a little bit of time to get started because of those reasons. But once we were able to get going and kind of things started to improve with the pandemic, we were able to accelerate our recruitment. But that's why the recruitment period for this trial was quite long, given those challenges. I have to take this opportunity to really thank the patients who participated in this trial. It's, as you mentioned, a lot of data that we obtained. In order to obtain that data, it requires a huge time commitment from these patients. Even though this trial was only 12 weeks long, the physiological assessments that took place really took a whole day with visits in between. So it was a big dedication from patients, especially at a very challenging time. So we're very grateful and appreciative to them for participating.
It's wonderful that you were able to accomplish this. So a couple of questions. One is, who funded the study? And then two, where did the name Infinity come from?
The study was funded by the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada, the Grant and Aid Program. And also we were very fortunate to be supported by philanthropy as well from the UHN, University Health Network, Edgemere Transplant Center, and the UHN Foundation. So collectively through those two avenues, we were able to get the study off the ground and completed. As you can imagine, it's a very expensive thing to do because it requires a lot of staff to conduct these studies in the lab. The name Infinity came from, we had to give the study a name, and we wanted to give the study a name that really reflected what we were trying to do, which was keep patients living as long as possible and keep kidneys going as long as possible. And so although Infinity seems like a little bit of a stretch goal, that's kind of where it came from, because that's what really we're trying to do, is kind of get to this vision of one transplant for life for patients when they get a transplant, and Infinity seemed to fit.
Well, I first thought it had something to do with someone's love of Buzz Lightyear and to infinity and beyond, but maybe not.
Although I like the comparison.
Well, let's talk about the study. Tell me about what your goals were and what kind of patients you were looking for from exclusion and inclusion criteria to enroll in this study.
The primary objective here was to try to see if we could identify if the mechanisms that had been demonstrated in non-transplant populations were present in this group. And that's what the primary objective was. We also had secondary objectives as well, though, which was to first determine the safety of these agents, and of course, to try to delineate other kind of secondary mechanisms beyond our primary outcome, which was reduction in systolic blood pressure. One of the things that was important is at that time, there was very little data in transplant recipients, limited to really case series and small studies. And so we had to really be safe, because that was really a reservation for a lot of people in terms of putting these patients on these drugs. They're immunosuppressed. We know that urinary tract infections are very common in this population, and people were concerned. And so one of the ways that we tried to make this trial as safe as possible, we said, well, listen, we're going to take people who are at least 6 months post-transplant. So they've had a chance to kind of achieve some degree of stability. We wanted stable transplant patients, particularly also because we were looking to identify mechanisms. So we want people who are kind of physiologically at their baseline. We don't want people who are going through acute events like acute rejection or rapid deterioration in graft function for an unexplained cause, because those are not kind of physiological steady state situations. And so one of the ways that we wanted to kind of get a group that was as stable as possible is to say no acute events in the past 30 days prior to recruitment, at least 6 months post-transplant. And we try to avoid physiological extremes. So patients with normal blood pressures that were either very low, very high, or BMIs that were very low, very high. And we wanted also to make this as generalizable as possible, because we know that these drugs are being used more and more in different populations, not just hypertensive populations or just people with diabetes. So it was a group of patients that we felt had to be as generalizable as possible, as broad as possible. That's why we included patients with and without hypertension. Initially, we included patients just with diabetes because the initial data was just in diabetes. But then when the DAPA-CKD trial was published, which happened to be published in the middle of recruitment, we did amend the trial to include patients without diabetes in the trial as well. So the goal here was to make the group as generalizable as possible, as broad as possible, but also safe by excluding people who were having acute events or acute changes in their health.
Just curious if y'all had an albuminuria cutoff for entry into the trial. And then I know some of the larger studies did not have an exclusion of prior urinary tract infections. Did you guys use that as an exclusion as well?
Yes, great question. So from a urinary tract infection perspective, we did not enroll anybody who had a urinary tract infection within the 30 days prior to screening. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't take anybody with a kind of recent UTI or people who had a history of urological or anatomical issues that could make them more predisposed to urinary tract infection. So that would include, for example, an indwelling catheter, need for intermittent catheterization, or known urological issues. We specifically did not have an albuminuria cutoff. We didn't have a minimum albuminuria level. And if you can see in table one, this is not a particularly albuminuric cohort. We were just really trying to maximize recruitment. And also this was a mechanistic study as opposed to an intervention trial. And so trying to understand the mechanisms across a wide variety of patients.
Yeah, I was looking at table one and being here in the United States and trying to change some of the parameters. I think UACR is listed as milligrams per millimole, and I think you just multiply that by 8 or so.
Yes, the units are a little bit different up here north of the border. And when you convert, is that it really isn't a very albuminuric cohort.
So if you do that conversion, it's 2.3, 2.5 for both the groups.
Correct.
Of milligrams per millimole, which is approximately about 16 to 18.
Yeah.
So really no albuminuria whatsoever. Before we start going through table one, I just want to understand, what were all the physiologic tests that you chose to do for these patients?
Great question. SGLT2 inhibitors exert their effects through various glucose-dependent and glucose-independent mechanisms. And what we were trying to do is see, well, can we ascertain whether those mechanisms are intact in kidney transplant recipients? So our primary outcome that we chose was blood pressure reduction, specifically systolic blood pressure reduction. We did that for a specific reason. We decided to pick a glucose-independent outcome measure as opposed to a glucose-dependent outcome measure. And the reason that was is we know that glucose reduction attenuates as GFR declines, whereas those glucose-independent effects are consistent across various strata of EGFR. And we know that transplant recipients, particularly those who get kidneys from deceased donors who are maybe more marginal, may not have great GFRs. And so we felt that having an outcome that was not glucose dependent was important. But we also wanted to look at other mechanistic effects that were described in non-transplant populations, including kidney function. So we used iohexol GFR to look at GFR changes. We looked at other metrics in terms of cardiovascular risk prediction, so arterial stiffness. Importantly, we wanted to look at naturesis. We, of course, know that SGLT2s exert this natriuretic effect. We wanted to see if that was present in transplant recipients. We wanted to look at changes in body weight, changes in lipids. We wanted to look, of course, at changes in albuminuria, changes in urine volume, glucosuria, and changes in sympathetic nervous system activity. So all these battery of tests that are really looking at answering the question, are those glucose-dependent and independent mechanisms that are described in non-transplant populations present in this group of transplant patients. That's really what we did. We decided to do this at baseline, of course, when patients came in for their first assessment, but also to do it 1 week later. We called that the acute visit. And then at the end of the trial at 12 weeks, which we called the chronic visit. So they were assessed at 3 time points throughout.
And then there was also some vascular measurements like arterial stiffness and maybe an echo. What other things were done outside of the urine and serum measurements that you had on the patients?
Assessment of blood pressure just as our primary outcome, but also assessment of arterial stiffness using aortic pulse wave velocity as well as augmentation index, which we used. We also wanted to look at sympathetic nervous system activity, and we looked at neurohormones as well. But those were the main ones that we looked at in terms of blood pressure. And then also we looked at non-invasive cardiovascular outcome monitoring as a way to get other metrics of cardiovascular health.
Can you go through table one and just give us a brief overview of the types of patients that were included in this study?
So this study was powered for 52 patients. 51 completed the study. One patient in the placebo group did not complete the trial. They were removed from the trial before randomization, but after screening for the development of a lupus flare. The vast majority were around 53 years of age. 62% of them had hypertension. 57% of them had type 2 diabetes. About 50% of them were on RAS blockade. 81% of them on statins. And the vast majority, 88%, were on triple immunosuppression, which is standard. You can see also that despite many efforts, 79% of the population was male. Most of them had excellent GFR. 68.2 mils per minute was the mean GFR in this cohort, and most of them were pretty far post-transplant with a post-transplant vintage of about 7.9 years. And as we've talked about before, the UACR levels were low and mean BMI was 37.
Just to summarize, this was planned to be a 12-week study. a lot of the interventions, the primary outcome was looking at blood pressure reduction.
So the primary outcome here was blood pressure reduction, specifically systolic blood pressure reduction. So what we were able to find is when you look at the DAPA group compared to placebo, blood pressure was lowered. Systolic blood pressure was lower at 1 week and at 12 weeks in the DAPA group, but it was not statistically different compared to placebo for that primary outcome of systolic blood pressure. So just to give you some numbers, at 1 week, the blood pressure, systolic blood pressure was lower by 4.4 millimeters of mercury in the DAPA group and 2.9 millimeters of mercury at 12 weeks in the DAPA group, but not statistically significant compared to placebo. When we looked at mean arterial pressure, so MAP at 1 week was reduced by about 3.9 millimeters of mercury. That was statistically significant. And although that change was sustained at 12 weeks, it was not statistically significant at the 12-week mark. So bottom line is what we're seeing is some reductions in blood pressure, although the only kind of statistical significant metric was MAP at 1 week. So there are blood pressure reductions, but certainly more muted than one would expect. We also did see changes in diastolic blood pressure in the NICOM, so the non-invasive cardiovascular outcome monitoring testing for diastolic blood pressure, and that was lower by about 5 millimeters of mercury at 12 weeks, and that was significant compared to placebo by NICOM.
Can you give us a brief discussion about what is NICOM?
An ICOM is basically a device that can use to measure cardiac output, stroke volume, other hemodynamic parameters, but in a non-invasive way. So it actually requires electrodes that you place on a patient, and it uses electrical impedance to try to measure these metrics. So the advantage here is that we could assess cardiac output, stroke volume, blood pressure, et cetera, without having to do anything invasive or without having to do, for example, an echocardiogram, a formal echocardiogram. So it was just another way to try to get to the physiological effects of these drugs in these patients. And of course, trying to keep things as non-invasive as possible.
What other aspects of the physiology would you like to highlight from the study?
The main things we want to highlight, first, what we did see is there were some reproducible things in this population that were similar compared to non-transplant populations. The biggest one is the eGFR drop. We saw a significant, statistically significant drop in GFR. And we did that by iohexol measured GFR at 1 week and 12 weeks. And that was statistically significant compared to placebo. And that is very similar to what we see in non-transplant populations. And the change in GFR was of similar magnitude also. So we know that that kind of drop in GFR was present. And we of course know from the non-transplant populations that that drop in GFR is what we think is protective in terms of preventing or delaying adverse renal outcomes. So that was important. We also saw other things that were important, like decrease in body weight. We were also able to see some changes in carotid arterial stiffness, although they weren't statistically significant. There were certainly metrics of change, although no. What was very interesting, though, is that what we expected to see was a natriuretic effect. That's what we expected to see when we started the trial, and we didn't. We actually saw that this was neutral from a natriuresis perspective. We looked at natriuretic effects, looking at fractional excretion of sodium, fractional excretion of lithium, and that was surprising to us. Now, it could be that these effects are not present because we weren't powered for that outcome, but there's certainly potential reasons to think that maybe that natriuretic effect is correct. There may be differences in this cohort, notably the use of calcineurin inhibitors, which are known to promote sodium retention. So there may be some differences there in the transplant population that exist. Now, I think the take home here is that there were some reproducible expected physiological pathways that were activated by SGLT2 inhibitors, but others that we expected would that weren't, and that may speak to potentially some heterogeneity in this group of unique patients.
I thought that was very interesting as well, and I was going to go back to a really interesting study from Jeff Testani in Circulation where they looked at this, and instead of after a week or even days, they had acute effects like within hours. And interestingly enough, just an SGLT2 inhibitor by itself really didn't change fractional excretion of sodium much. However, if you then added on an acute administration of a diuretic, it seems to have a more potent effect than the diuretic alone. And I looked at that and call it a diuretic enabler. I was also thinking to this study, this was done a week after, and probably at that point, homeostasis would have occurred. So maybe these perturbations at that point that might have occurred earlier on might sort of then be hard to really see 1 week later. So I don't know. To me, looking at that and looking at prior data, I'm not that surprised.
that could have explained also why we didn't see this natriuretic effect. And as you say, we're measuring at three discrete time points, baseline 1 week, 12 weeks. In an ideal world, if we could measure this on a daily basis right after the initiation of the drug, wouldn't that be a really powerful study to do? But again, practically, we felt that we wanted to ascertain acute and chronic effects, and this was the way that we felt we could do it in a practical way.
I think that you hit the nail on the head right there. So maybe we can segue into the future of this. Will we ever see a large outcomes-driven trial, either cardiovascular or kidney-related, in a kidney transplant population?
I hope that we won't be in a position 10 years from now where we don't have an answer to the question of, do SGLT2 inhibitors decrease cardiovascular and renal adverse outcomes in the transplant population? So I think the time really is now for a trial. We absolutely need a trial. We know that trials are challenging to do, much, much more challenging in transplant patients just because of the sheer number of patients that are required. So it does require a little bit of creativity in terms of kind of trying to power this study adequately using more creative outcome measures, potentially to answer the questions of, are these protective? For example, using a more hierarchical outcome. I am hopeful that we will have a trial in this space. There is, of course, a trial underway called the Renal Life Cycle Trial that is including patients that are on dialysis as well as transplant recipients looking at this issue. I'm part of a group that's putting together an application at the moment for a trial, but I think just so, so important to have a trial in this space and to persevere in terms of trying to answer the question. Because as I mentioned before, the consequence of not having a trial really leaves us where there's ongoing equipoise. And given the large burden of cardiovascular and chronic kidney disease in this population, really, it's important to try to see if we can advance therapies from a cardio-kidney protection perspective in this group.
Totally agree. I want to go back to the study and just ask one question about safety. Obviously, it was a key component to this. And also one of the key thoughts when you're considering this in this population is especially infection. Did y'all see any signal towards safety? And can you comment on that?
Yes, absolutely. So, so important to talk about safety. Understandably, people have reservations about using SGLT2 inhibitors, given just how common UTIs are in the transplant population and the immunosuppressed state. What was really great to see in our study is that this drug was safe over the 12-week period. It was very well tolerated. We had a 98% adherence to the drug throughout the trial. And we did not see any urinary tract infections in this population. We did not see any ketoacidosis in this population in this trial. We did not see any kind of fungal infections. We did see 4 mild hypoglycemic episodes, 2 in the placebo group, 2 in the dapagliflozin group. There was 1 mild AKI in the DAPA group and 1 mild volume depletion episode in the placebo group. But really what we can say here is that these drugs in this trial were very safe. And I think that really goes along with kind of the data that exists, the non-trial data that currently exists that is published so far, is that we're not seeing a major signal of increased harm for these drugs in this population.
Is there any particular type of transplant patient that you would strongly consider using SGLT2 inhibitor now on?
Obviously, we'd want a dedicated transplant trial to answer the question before we start putting everybody on these drugs. But that being said, we know that there's established benefits for certain groups. Patients with type 2 diabetes, with cardiovascular risk factors, we know with patients with heart failure, with preserved or reduced ejection fractions, those patients fall in the category of known groups that benefit from these agents. So I think it's important to recognize, although we want to do a trial and it's important to enroll patients in that trial, acknowledging, of course, that most of the trials did not include immunosuppressed transplant populations. But in an ideal state, the transplant trial can be done sooner rather than later. So we are in a position where we're not just putting patients on the drug without an opportunity to enroll them in a trial.
Thank you so much for spending time with us on the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's been a real pleasure. Of course, thank you again for the opportunity to share this work with the audience.
Our next paper to discuss on this episode of the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast is from Jason and is titled Labor and Delivery Outcomes in Australian Mothers After Kidney Transplantation. We have 2 authors joining us today. First is Dr. Jesu Dawson.
Hi, my name's Shilpa Jesudarsan. I'm the head of nephrology and transplantation at the Royal Adelaide Hospital in Adelaide, Australia. And I'm chair of the Australian and New Zealand Dialysis and Transplant Registry Parenthood Data Working Group, and really delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
And we also have Dr. Hewa Wasam.
Thanks, Matt. I'm Erandi Hewa Wasam. I'm a research scientist at the Centre for Big Data Research in Health at the University of New South Wales. And before that, I spent several years working with the Australia and New Zealand Dialysis and Transplant Registry, which is the ANSTAR registry, at the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, where a lot of this work was carried out. Thanks for inviting me. I'm grateful to be here today to discuss this paper with you.
One thing I always like to think about is the delivery of data really helps open your eyes up into the real issues that are happening. So tell us a little bit about this registry and a little bit about how this project got started. Love to hear about how this all happened.
So the ANSDATA registry has been collecting some information about parenthood events in dialyzed and transplanted women since its inception in the late 60s, early 70s. And then in 2001, they created a formal parenthood data collection. And a number of us have been using that data to provide evidence based around these pregnancy outcomes for a while. But what we were missing was the really detailed pregnancy data that the Dialysis and Transplant Registry doesn't collect. When you then switch over and have a look at what is in the perinatal data sets, which are captured for all women who have a delivery in Australia, there's a lot of pregnancy specific data, particularly around labour and delivery, but none of the renal information that we collect in the registry. It now feels like a very long time ago. We started a process, and this was a project that I led, to link these two data sets together. And so we linked ANSDATA with perinatal registries in four Australian states and territories. And this was an enormous project that eventually gave us nearly 3 million births to work with. So that's why we feel that the data is robust, because we're putting these two very important data sources together. We've been able to interrogate a lot of questions that haven't been able to be answered before because of that data linkage. And this paper around labour and delivery was something that, until we had that linked data, we would not have been able to answer these really detailed questions about how transplanted women were having their obstetric deliveries. The real power of this was to get national data from 1991 through to 2013, with the last follow-up being 2016. And that's given us this sizable cohort for what is essentially a fairly rare event.
What was known before this paper was published, and what kind of questions in your mind did you have that could be answered by a data set like this?
When we started this study, we knew that cesarean section rates were so high among women with kidney transplants, usually about 50 to 60% internationally. But what we didn't really understand is why, and the reasons behind this high cesarean section rate. Was it the pregnancy complications? Was it the woman's birth history? Or is it the wider population trends that we see, or differences in clinical decision making? And I'm sure Shilpa may have something to add around clinical decision making. And for transplant recipients coming into their final trimester, the timing is critically important. It's a balance between risk of delivering too early versus prolonging the pregnancy. And that uncertainty, I think, can naturally lead to variations in how these pregnancies are managed by each clinician. And as Yupa mentioned, the ANS data and the perinatal data sets linkage actually helped us answer these questions and look at this data really carefully and look at whether how labor starts, why cesareans are done, when the deliveries actually happen, and how previous birth modes can influence decisions. And no one had examined these questions at this level of detail before.
No, just curious about the question about why a cesarean section was performed. Do you have that granular data where you can go back and have a determination of the exact reason why, or is it something that you ascertain based upon the clinical factors that were happening at the time?
So in this data set, we had the indications for cesarean sections. And the key ones that came up were hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, particularly for planned cesarean sections. And the other one was breech presentation. Those were the top two that came up. But one of the challenges was that most of the indications were categorized as other or unspecified, so which made it really challenging to actually draw a conclusion on what the reason for the cesarean section. But the top two were the hypertensive disorders of pregnancy and breech.
What we'd love to be able to do is go back and ask each clinician, why did you deliver in this way? Now, registry data is and administrative data sets are never going to give you that answer, but that's certainly going to be one of the next pieces of work we do from this, which is to understand the drivers behind that decision making. A lot of the time we are dealing with preterm births. These are high-risk pregnancies in transplanted women, but we want to give a reassuring message that overwhelmingly the outcomes are good, even though rates of preterm birth are high. It's often late preterm. What we want to understand is what are the drivers of decision making that go through the minds of obstetricians and the nephrologists and obstetric physicians looking after these patients. We won't get to that in this data, but we're going to raise a lot of questions that we can go back and ask these clinicians. The decision to deliver one way or another is very complex. And I think a lot of factors drive that decision making. But I wonder if clinician fear is one of them. When we're doing our preconception counselling, sometimes when we're first talking to the obstetricians, their immediate assumption is that cesarean delivery will be necessary. And I think what this data shows is that actually a non-cesarean delivery, labour delivery, and vaginal delivery are actually quite safe, and even though not as common, can be very safely done in transplanted women.
Let's go to table one and just talk about the numbers and the comparisons and how many patients actually did deliver a baby during transplantation.
These were births that were more than 20 weeks gestation because that's what the perinatal data sets collect in each state. We basically had two main cohorts, just to let everyone know. So we had our cohort of interest really is the women who had a functioning kidney transplant before giving birth. And then our comparator cohort was women who had never received dialysis or had a kidney transplant, or in other words, they didn't have kidney replacement therapy. And in terms of numbers, we had 137 transplant mothers and 211 babies. And our comparator group was 1.6 million mothers, and that's nearly 3 million babies. So it did give us a large, very complete national picture of labor and delivery among these women in Australia.
Can you go through the years again that this captures? How many years and what years that it covered?
Yes, so it's from 1991 to 2013. So it captures data or births over 22 years.
Anything on table one that you want to point out?
I think the key messages here are obviously we already know the high cesarean section rate. So over 50% of these women delivered by cesarean section. And that the majority of those women, much, much higher than in the non-kidney replacement therapy cohort, had actually never had a history of cesarean section. Now, if you've already had one cesarean section, you're much, much more likely to go on and have another cesarean section in a subsequent delivery. But you can see that in the non-kidney replacement therapy cohort, that was only 19% of women who'd had no previous history of cesarean section, but who had a cesarean section in the current pregnancy, but it was 53% in the transplant cohort. The other key message here is that spontaneous labour was much lower in this group. So, this is a group of women who are not getting to the point of spontaneous labour. It's half the rates compared to the non-kidney replacement therapy group. They're much more likely to have an induction or to have no labour at all, in which case they just go straight to a cesarean section. And that's where the link with the hypertensive disorders of pregnancy becomes important because what's happening there is that women are getting medical complications in pregnancy, such as hypertension and preeclampsia, and then going straight to often an emergency delivery. And that's what will drive the cesarean section rate.
So in terms of other key points that came out was the breach percentation, as you can see, was much higher among women who had kidney transplants. That was initially quite surprising to us. We know that this group has more preterm birth, so that probably might be why we are seeing more breach among this cohort. Another thing that sort of came out was the higher use of general anesthesia among women with kidney transplants compared to the comparator cohort. We didn't expect that. And that might be because they may be having emergency cesarean sections or maybe complex deliveries that clinicians might be deciding to just put them under general anesthesia, expecting that those sort of complications. And we also saw higher postpartum hemorrhage and fetal distress among women with kidney transplants compared to the comparator cohort. So those were the two sort of main sort of complications of labor that we had. But those who did go on to have a vaginal delivery, we did see in the end them having good outcomes.
I'm looking at this figure one, which I think is just an absolutely fabulous picture called the journey map. And it really gives you a nice visual that sometimes the data is hard to understand and look at. But this is really cool because it takes the women and basically as you go through the journey, looks like if you go down on their plot, that means that they had a vaginal delivery. And if you go up, you had a cesarean. And you can see that in the transplant world happened a lot more often as compared to the non-kidney transplant, which I think is fascinating to see that. Whose idea was it for that figure? I don't think I've seen a figure like that before.
So this is a great place to mention our wonderful co-author who's actually listed on the paper. So this is Arandi and Dr. Nishanta Tangarala are joint first authors for this paper, Pregnancy Management and Labour and Delivery Management. This is actually a really complex area, and it speaks back to that complex decision making that I was talking about earlier that the obstetricians go through. Because if you have had a previous cesarean section, even before you develop renal failure, it doesn't matter when you had that cesarean section. It may not have been in a transplant pregnancy. You are much more likely, from an obstetric point of view, to go on and have a subsequent cesarean section. And that was the bit that we really wanted to answer with this more complex data, because the perinatal data set did give us some of that past obstetric history, and we had really important information about parity and previous cesarean section. And this helped us unpick how the past obstetric history was defining what was happening in this pregnancy for transplanted women. Now, a lot of our transplanted patients were nulliparous. They'd not had a previous pregnancy, so we had to take that into account as well. And so, how do you pick all of that out? If we'd done it with a complex table, no one would have understood the data. And Matthew, I think you're quite right. Showing it visually like this was, I think, the most effective way to do it. And I'm glad you like the visual, because we spent several months working on this, particularly Arandi and Nishanta pulling this together. It does show you that the differences between what we're seeing in the transplanted cohort versus non-transplant. The nulliparous status of these women is probably because they've been told not to have pregnancies during their CKD journey. And we know from other work that we've done in our research group that clinicians hold out the post-transplant period as the golden time to have a pregnancy. What we actually know is that post-transplant pregnancies can be as complicated as pregnancies with advanced chronic kidney disease, and there's evidence emerging to show that. So the timing of these pregnancies is critically important for these women, and we know that it may not be necessary to hold out post-transplant, but that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of women who are having their first child post-transplant.
Moving on now to table two, there's a lot of on this table discussing the maternal and fetal characteristics. Can you go through this and give us an idea about what you showed in this piece of data?
Table two was really showing the different types of ways in which these women could deliver. So we show here spontaneous labour with vaginal delivery, which is like the stock standard way of delivering. And then we've got spontaneous labour, but then you go on to have a cesarean section. induction of labor, but then you go on to have a vaginal delivery, induction of labor, but then you go on to have a cesarean section, and then no labor, no induction, you just go straight to a cesarean section. So these are the different ways in which women can deliver. And we felt it was really important to highlight all of these different pathways and give some analysis of the different types of women that were being managed through these different labor and delivery pathways. And what we saw really was not a lot of difference in some of the maternal factors and comorbidities or the era according to how these different types of delivery happened. What we're seeing is that gestational age is an important factor in whether women deliver via these different types of labor and delivery scenarios. And essentially, the earlier the delivery, the more likely they are to go straight to a cesarean section. And that makes sense. You can imagine what's happening clinically. The baby is preterm, a delivery needs to happen. It's likely to be due to growth restriction or some maternal medical complications, such as graft dysfunction or hypertensive disorder of pregnancy. And there may not be time to go through an induction and then delivery process. And these women are having emergency cesarean sections. That's the scenario that we're gleaning from this data. And then the birth weight data follows along with that. Obviously, the earlier the pregnancy, the lower the birth weight, and so on and so forth. I think what we can see here is the numbers are pretty small in each of the different categories. But overall, we are seeing the majority of women having an induction of labour and then going on to have a cesarean section. That is the most common scenario here. Even in the cohort of women that went straight to a non-labour cesarean section, the median gestational age was 34 weeks. That's still not very, very early preterm birth. And overall, even in the group that had spontaneous labor, we're getting these women to 36, 38 weeks, which is an excellent outcome. I think this characterization of pregnancies in transplanted women having high preterm rates, we do need to recognize that this is late preterm for the majority of women. And the numbers of women with very early preterm delivery are actually quite small. So this is a positive, I think, in terms of the messaging that we can give these women. Yes, it is likely that your babies will be born earlier, but not on the majority, on the whole, not super early, probably just a little bit early. And if you do have a complication of pregnancy and the baby's not growing well and there's blood pressure problems in pregnancy, then it is likely your baby will be born a little bit earlier, but at a point where fetal viability is very likely. Safety of the baby is very likely.
Did your data capture any negative consequences to the kidney transplant? Any rejection episodes or any negative consequences that might need to be discussed as well?
So we haven't explored that in this, or we didn't really look at this in this paper, but in other work that we have done, we have seen pretty good graft function, very minimal rejection issues in women who are having pregnancies and who have had kidney transplants in the long term, up to maybe 20 years of follow-up, if I'm not wrong.
So, in previous studies, we've explored the issue of the impact of pregnancy on graft function in a lot of detail. And the headline piece of news there is that the better your graft function going into pregnancy, the less likely pregnancy is going to have an impact. The women who do have a deterioration in graft function postpartum are most likely the ones who had poor graft function going into the pregnancy. Preconception kidney function is the main predictor of long-term graft outcomes. And in fact, in a CJASN paper that we published a few years ago, we looked in detail at the impact of having preeclampsia and whether that accelerated graft decline postpartum, because preeclampsia is essentially a really important and the world's most common acute kidney injury. And so we were really concerned that, okay, we're seeing really high preeclampsia rates in transplanted women. We've in Australia, we've our ANZ data registry data has shown us that preeclampsia rates captured in the registry are much higher than they were previously. And that might be because we're reporting it better, or indeed there may be more preeclampsia. And so we were really concerned that does this have an impact on graft function? And the bottom line is it doesn't. When we did our survival curves, preeclampsia, no preeclampsia, the graft survival curves were similar. So that's from previous work. And heads up for some work that we're hoping to put together and get out there fairly soon. We've also been looking at a matched cohort study of women who had pregnancies and didn't have pregnancies post-transplant. And again, not really seeing any great impact of pregnancy on long-term graft outcomes. So I think that's a really reassuring message. One of the things we hear from clinicians and patients is the great concern that a pregnancy will lead them to lose their graft, particularly if graft function is a bit tenuous. And our data shows that's not necessarily the case. It's not definitely going to happen. A lot of these women stay very static with their graft function. Some of our patients tell us that they see no better use of their precious kidney transplant than using it to help them achieve their very precious family. So this is a very individualized decision for these women, and that's a lot of what we talk about and talk through in our counseling.
You mentioned earlier in the podcast that part of the message is to show that spontaneous vaginal birth is possible and safe. And that's a really important message to hear here, especially in this day and age when probably it's becoming more and more rare. Any last comments surrounding the paper?
I think one of the strengths of this paper was we were able to use the perinatal data sets that collect an enormous depth of data on labour and delivery. We were able to look at the complications of labour, and as Randy pointed out earlier, we did show slightly higher postpartum hemorrhage rates and fetal distress rates in the transplanted babies and pregnancies. But the numbers are fairly small. And the event rates are fairly small. So we need to be cautious in our interpretation where we've got very low event rates. But I think overall, this tells us the message that these are complex pregnancies. We do see higher rates of maternal complications in pregnancy, particularly hypertensive disorders, higher rates of more invasive anesthesia, more invasive delivery types, and complications. But by and large, the message to mothers is that they will likely to walk away with a live baby who may be born preterm but not extremely preterm. And while the pregnancies are likely to be more medically complex for mother and baby, they are achievable, and particularly in places where there are very good levels of obstetric and perinatal care. A key message is that this was data from a very well-developed, highly resourced health system and clearly cannot be extrapolated to every transplanted woman in the world in every setting. So we need to interpret that with caution as well. My final comment would be post-transplant is far too late to be talking about these issues with your patients. Our research group have done a lot of work, as have many others around the world, defining the patient voice here. And the simple message is start these conversations early as possible. Raise this with women in earlier stages of chronic kidney disease or as soon as you can along the kidney journey. You'll find that women are relieved and delighted that you've brought this up. They're often frightened to bring it up with their clinicians because there's so much else going on around their kidney care. But this is an important issue for patients, and they will thank you for having raised it and putting it on the table as a normal part of their kidney journey.
Well, that's a wonderful point to close the podcast. Thank you so much to both of you for coming today, spending time with us, and congratulations on executing this really important paper. Our last paper is from Kidney360, and we'll be joined by Dr. Amanda Lamberg-Yu from the University of Pennsylvania. She'll be talking about her paper titled Strategic Innovations to Reduce Disincentives and Increase Living Kidney Donation. Welcome.
Hello, everyone. My name is Amanda Lienberg-Yu. I'm a general nephrologist at Penn Medicine, and I am the medical director for the Living Kidney Donor Program at Penn.
Well, thank you so much for joining. It has really been just amazing to see the growth of transplantation since I was a fellow 15, 20 years ago. And especially that growth has been in living donation. The innovations have really occurred really fast. Can you tell us a little bit about how this project started and where we have come in living kidney donation?
So we know that living kidney donation is the best form of kidney replacement therapy one can be offered for kidney failure. It's actually associated with superior clinical outcomes, longer graft survival, better long-term kidney function, reduction in post-transplant delayed graft function, and it happens more quickly as compared to the wait list for deceased donors. So better quality of organ, better match, less wait time. There's a fairly striking gap between interest and action. In the general population, over 60% of Americans actually endorse considering donating a kidney, but only about 6,000 living kidney donors actually occur each year. Although there was an initial rise in living kidney donation immediately pre-COVID, during COVID, the living kidney donation actually declined somewhat. As expected, we could not guarantee safety of living kidney donation. And more recently, we are hoping that we see a slight rise, but it is somewhat early to make that conclusion. But some of these innovations that the National Kidney Registry and others are promoting, I think, have helped promote awareness and increase growth in living kidney donation in the United States.
The National Kidney Registry, it's not something that a lot of nephrologists likely know about. When did this start and what exactly is it?
So the National Kidney Registry started in the early 2000s. It was an idea that was generated by the chief executive officer, Garrett Hill, when he tried to donate a kidney to his daughter, but was unable to because he was not a direct match. She ultimately went on to receive a kidney transplant, but he began to think about the mismatch occurring and how could an organization like the NKR promote paired kidney donation by helping to overcome some of the barriers of logistics and in the matching itself. And so that's what they did. They have grown in size. So not every transplant center partners with the National Kidney Registry for paired exchange, but it is the largest living kidney donation organization that allows for these paired exchanges in the U.S.
What were the barriers at the time? Remember, if you had a living donor, you'd see if it was a good match. If it was, great. If not, that's where the challenges started. And I remember it wasn't so long ago that the first paired exchanges were started, but this takes it to another level.
Interest in incompatibility defined by blood type. So incompatible blood type donors and recipients could not, you know, benefit the recipient by donation. So overcoming that initial blood type incompatibility through paired exchange has not been novel, and many centers actually do that internally. So finding a donor recipient pair within the same transplant center can allow you to make these swaps. What the National Kidney Registry has done has expanded from not just blood type incompatibility, but also HLA incompatibility, other subsets of HLA, these are the eplet mismatches, and even thinking about EBV or CMV mismatch, you can be much more prescriptive in the pairing that you're willing to consider because it's such a large registry, so the denominator is a lot bigger. So that's kind of the biologic compatibility component. The other innovation that the NKR has thought about has been, what about distance incompatibility? What if your intended recipient lives in the West Coast, you're a busy person on the East Coast, how are you going to make that happen? So distance incompatibility can be overcome by this type of registry. And the third thing is actually time incompatibility. So thinking about parent to child, child isn't necessarily in need of a kidney transplant right now, but maybe in the future. Parent could actually donate now, and the child could receive a voucher to have on hand in the event that a kidney transplant is needed in the future. So there's more than one type of incompatibility, and this registry has kind of thought about each incompatibility and how to overcome those barriers.
Like, how has it done to increase the number of kidney transplants that are done living donor compared to prior when we didn't have the National Kidney Registry?
So on an individual center level, there can be growth just by virtue of offering paired exchanges. And so you're capable of a larger pool of matching by partnering with more of a national organization. From the national organization perspective, the National Kidney Registry does publish updates and, I guess, volumes and how their volumes have changed over time. And
just by growth alone within the NKR from the early 2000s until now, there's actually been a 22% increase growth in living donor transplantation. Now, that is unique to those centers who participate with the NKR. So it may be other variables that play a role in that increased growth. But I'd like to believe that some of the innovations they've put in have also afforded increased donor support and allowance for more transplants.
Let's move on and talk about your paper. The title is Strategic Innovations to Reduce Disincentives to Increase Living Kidney Donations. Tell us about what questions you're trying to answer with this manuscript and how did you go about answering those questions?
The National Kidney Registry has put in place several programmatic innovations to increase living kidney donation. However, they have not been rigorously studied to understand the impact of those innovations. We don't know who's using the innovations or what the impact may be on registration, referral, and ultimate donation. And so that's what the goal of this paper was, to analyze these strategies and observe the impact of not just who is using each of the innovations, but also how it's impacted the registration, referral, and donation is also an outcome that may not be as robust for this paper because there are other reasons why someone may or may not pursue the donation. But that was the goal of the paper.
So when you talk about innovations, it sounds like the National Kidney Registry have several or many different facets to try to increase living donation. Can you describe what those innovations are?
We looked at three different innovations, and the three innovations were actually tied to barriers that are known related to people coming forward for living kidney donation. The first is uncertainty about the process and the expectations around living kidney donation. The solution to that was creating a mentorship program called Donor Connect that links those individuals interested in registering and ultimately being evaluated as living donors with prior living donors. So it gives you a little bit more of a personalized navigator through the process. Barrier number two, geographical access. And so I'd mentioned that distance donation where a person on one side of the United States may be trying to donate to a recipient on the other side of the United States. How does that geographic access disincentivize donors? And so through an innovation called remote donation, the National Kidney Registry has tried to reduce that geographic barrier. The third innovation we looked at was the financial burden. So although the living donation evaluation, surgery and post-operative care, which is up to 2 years post-donation, that is all covered under a recipient's insurance. There's several out-of-pocket costs that are incurred by donors, and sometimes those can be significant, thinking about time off of work, so lost wages, dependent care, access and travel to and from the transplant center. These cumulative economic barriers add up. And therefore, addition of something called Donor Shield, which is a financial assistance package that is offered to living donors by the National Kidney Registry, has tried to overcome that economic barrier.
Let's go through and understand more about what you showed with how these innovations impacted living donation.
So the first one we looked at was the Donor Connect program. The Donor Connect program is the mentorship program where for individuals who register to be a living donor through the National Kidney Registry are linked with a living donor themselves who can shepherd them through the process. So it's a navigator program. This gets around the barrier of managing donor expectations. What we found in our paper was that for those individuals who participated in the Donor Connect, more complete information was captured on the registration form. There was an increase in conversion from registration, which is you go online, you fill out a registration form, to referral, which is you actually go to are assigned a living donor center and are referred to become a living donor. There was an increase in donation rate as well, although there could have been other factors that actually influenced that outcome. But the conclusion from the Donor Connect and the Donor Mentorship Program was that it seemed to help with the forward movement through the process.
I've seen they have these similar sort of setups for patients on dialysis, which seemed to be really impactful as well. CKD as well, and trying to figure out what modality to choose. It seems like a great innovation and something we should be doing across all parts of kidney care, not just transplantation, but having really a program, big one like this, that allows all centers to participate probably without having to put a lot of effort on the center is very helpful. What's the second innovation that you guys looked at?
The second innovation was overcoming the geographic barrier, so remote donation. This is a concept where you can actually donate in the comfort of your hometown around the support system that you have locally, but your intended recipient can still be the beneficiary of that kidney. It could be your kidney is being flown from the East Coast to the West Coast, or it could be that your intended recipient receives a paired donation through that paired exchange program, but it allows for reduction in geographic barriers.
Tell us what that innovation showed in making an impact in increasing a living donation.
So in the remote donation cohort, 11% of those who ultimately donated during the study period participated in remote donation. The closer access to the transplant center seemed to be the predictor for proceeding with living kidney donation. So distance to the donation center was important. The remote donation program actually significantly reduced the travel burden by almost 600 miles, allowing the donor to be in the comfort of their own home. What this suggests is that those individuals who are more likely to participate in remote donation may be more likely to actually donate locally. And so I think it's an interesting thread that I think needs a little bit more development to understand who's using remote donation, what the conversion from referral to donation is on a larger scale, and how we can maybe socialize this more to others.
So it sounds like to me that this innovation, although impactful for a small number, really hasn't made the larger impact that maybe it can make in the future.
Yeah, what the paper did show is that candidates living within 50 miles of the transplant center did have a higher conversion rate. So it's small numbers, but it is food for thought that perhaps bringing the care to your environment, to your support network, may allow people to overcome that, not just geographic access barrier, but also the support network barrier. You need your own support system post-living kidney donation.
I mean, almost like in the back of my head, when I think about living kidney donation, like giving to a loved one, you sort of have in this in your mind, like being in the same hospital, maybe like across the hall, and that sort of vision is sort of lost here. However, I think that's where you have to reimagine it and recognize like, wow, the gift that you're giving to someone to get off dialysis or never even be on dialysis is totally something that we need to be trying to achieve.
And that point you bring up, that's a it's a tangible benefit, but it's hard to quantify. So it's the pursuit of helping others and maybe more than one person if you're involved in a paired exchange. That is something that many living donors cite as a reason, one of their motivations for pursuit. It's you become part of a larger thing, something larger than yourself, and involvement in advocacy groups, et cetera, continues. And that's actually how the mentor program started. You know, it was prior donors saying, we want to continue to give back.
Stay involved. The last innovation, I think this is the elephant in the room. It is a big ordeal to stay out of work, to travel to a new location, incur medical expenses, to take care of your family, they rely upon you. So tell us about this. I'm really interested to hear about how this program tackles this issue and how you sought to understand it more.
So the donor shield is the last innovation we looked at, and that does get to the financial barrier that often prevents folks from coming forward. In this paper, we were looking simply at trying to understand who received cost reimbursement through the Donor Shield program and what the differences may be. That's the first step, I think, in understanding how that may be impactful in the future, just comparison of those who used versus those that did not. So about 51% of living donors in the study period did receive cost reimbursement through the Donor Shield program. And there were some subtle differences. Donors who received reimbursement were a little bit younger. There was no statistically significant gender distribution difference nor educational attainment, although those who reported a high school diploma, GED, or associate's level were more likely to receive reimbursement compared to those that weren't. There were some differences in racial and ethnic composition as well. Donors who received reimbursement were more racially and ethnically diverse. And so that may also be something to consider in the future of how to ensure equitable access to living kidney donation.
So how was the process to basically reimburse individuals for lost wages, or how is that done?
So the National Kidney Registry sponsors this program called Donor Shield. However, there are other programs. There's actually one through the United States government called the National Living Donor Assistance Center, also provides lost wages and reimbursement for living kidney donation. And there's also a similar program through the Veterans Administration for those who are veterans interested in pursuing living kidney donation. Other programs outside of the National Kidney Registry also include centers of employment. So many centers of employment participate in something called the Circle of Excellence. So companies that are part of the Circle of Excellence provide paid time off for living organ donation. So there are many groups that are invested in improving the financial barrier and increasing financial protection for living donors. The Donor Shield, I think, probably has the biggest impact because they actually have a total financial assistance of up to $18,000. The majority of that does come through lost wages and reimbursement. And so submission of information about the wages lost is required. Travel expenses are capped at $6,000 as a maximum, and there's also a dependent care clause. The Donor Shield is very much living donor centric, whereas the National Living Donor Assistance Center actually requires information about the recipient. And so sometimes that can be a barrier to actually fulfilling the information needed to provide that financial assistance. So the Donor Shield, I think it's largely orchestrated by the transplant center. So generally it's a social worker or a living donor coordinator that helps the individual submit receipts, and they receive, I believe it's a credit card or it's some sort of financial benefit that's delivered to them post-donation.
Well, I'm sure these are just the tip of the iceberg for what the National Kidney Registry can achieve. And I want to hear about the future. What is the future of this program? Where are the areas in which the program has been shifting and changing? And what is the ceiling for a living donation?
I think it's a really exciting time to think about how this may impact living kidney donation. You're right, it is the tip of the iceberg. This paper has really tried to describe the innovations and look preliminarily at how it's helped some of the registration and the conversion rates. I think the next hurdle is thinking about comparing those who use these innovations versus those that don't. So comparison of the innovations may help us understand the impact of a more controlled group, and also will help us understand, are there other innovations or other barriers that we haven't thought of? These have all really tried to expand the donor pool and improve efficiency and reduce barriers. And I think the overall donor experience is the unwritten part of this. The overall donor experience, I think, is enhanced by not just companies, but transplant centers who are thinking purely about living donor needs. Living donor needs are very different than recipient needs. These are healthy people that don't need to interact with the healthcare system. So I think we do have to lower the barrier to it.
100%. This really expands the options, but still leaves the other options available for people. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about this really important area. And congratulations to you and your team for your paper in Kidney 360. And thank you so much to our listeners of the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We look forward to our next episode. And we thank everyone for listening.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.